Or what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In his final national security speech Tuesday, President Barack Obama called U.S. military personnel at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida that no foreign terrorist organization has successfully planned or executed an attack on U.S. homeland during his time in office. Discussing his administration's 8-year record, Mr. Obama said al-Qaeda has been all but defeated.
Today, by any measure, core al-Qaeda, the organization that hit us on 9/11, is a shadow of its former self.
He also insisted Islamic State is on the run.
ISIL has lost more than half its territory. ISIL has lost control of major population centers. Its morale is plummeting. Its recruitment is drying up. Its commanders and external plotters are being taken out, and local populations are turning against it.
But Mr. Obama, who leaves office in just 6 weeks, said the U.S. will not be able to destroy terrorism with military might alone. He called for the pursuit of a smart strategy that focuses on coalition building and upholds U.S. values and the rule of law. He denounced the use of torture, warned that terrorism will remain a threat for years to come. A purported senior commander of the renegade Lord's Resistance Army pleaded not guilty Tuesday to dozens of crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, forced marriage, and recruiting child soldiers. Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda pressed her case against Dominic Ongwen.
These were innocent people who had no interest in the violent conflict which was taking place in northern Uganda. Some were brutally tortured in various cruel ways. Hundreds of them were abducted and forced to carry away the goods which had been pillaged.
Bensouda described Ongwen, himself a child soldier who rose swiftly through the ranks because of his reputation as a ruthless killer. This is VOA News. Syrian and allied forces have reportedly penetrated deeper into rebel-held Aleppo. The rebels are believed to have lost up to 3/4 of their territory in the embattled city over the past 2 weeks. Monday, Russia and China vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that would have imposed a week-long ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid to reach tens of thousands of trapped civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Moscow are at odds over talks to be held in Geneva that Russia said will focus on the withdrawal of rebel forces. Iraqi army units Tuesday surged towards the center of the Islamic State-occupied city of Mosul in an offensive begun 7 weeks ago. One commander said his forces entered al-Salam Hospital near the Tigris River. Fighting is reported as heavy. The Iraqis, backed by airstrikes, face improvised explosive devices, snipers, and suicide attacks. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, at a farewell tour of Europe Tuesday, reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to NATO, the alliance that President-elect Donald Trump has criticized for lacking the necessary funding of its own defense, and prepares to take office next month.
And I'm quite confident that they will remain committed to the fundamental core components of the transatlantic alliance and America's partnership with NATO and with the EU. I have no doubt about that. Now, whether there's a twist about pressure on funding or how they begin to engage, that's going to be their choice, and I'm not going to second guess it now in a blank.
The European Union's foreign policy chief joined NATO foreign ministers in endorsing more than 40 proposals to boost cooperation on matters such as cybersecurity, sea operations, and helping neighboring countries defend themselves. The UN Atomic Energy Agency Tuesday said Iran shipped 11 tons of heavy water abroad, bringing its stock under a limit set by an international nuclear agreement reached last year. The International Atomic Energy Agency warned last month Tehran's stock of heavy water exceeded a limit of 130 tons. Wednesday marks the 75th anniversary of the surprise Japanese attack on U.S. naval and air forces at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, prompting U.S. entry into World War II. The December 7, 1941 attack killed hundreds of U.S. military personnel, sank or damaged many capital ships. Monday, Japan's Prime Minister Abe announced he'll visit Pearl Harbor, the first Japanese leader to do so. Wall Street edged higher again Tuesday, with the benchmark Dow Jones average gaining another 22 points to close at 19,238. Shares have climbed 15% since the November 8 election of President-elect Trump. U.S. worker productivity advanced in the third quarter at a 3.1% rate after 3/4 of decline, and factory orders jumped at the biggest level in 16 months in October. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghanaians are voting today in presidential and parliamentary elections.
The election is all about the economy to me, because as a businessman, all I'm looking for is for the economy to be good. So let's say I can import more, get money, so things will be okay with me.
Frank Boima is a Ghanaian businessman. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs is optimistic Ghana will live up to its history of holding peaceful elections. Cameroon's government dispatches English-speaking ministers to calm violent protests. And a U.S. envoy is urging DRC President Joseph Kabila to reach an agreement with the opposition before December 19th.
Our most urgent message is the absolute importance of full cooperation with the CENCO process run by the Catholic bishops to try to organize a broad consensus among the key stakeholders on how we can move forward.
Tom Perello is the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa. Nigeria and the U.N. officials are working to prevent the humanitarian crisis in northern Nigeria from spinning out of control. And Malawi's religious group protests against a proposed law that would liberalize abortion. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaians are voting today, Wednesday, in presidential and parlementary election. President John Dramani Mahama is seeking a full term after taking over from John Atta Mills, who died in 2012. He's being challenged by three other candidates, including Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriot Party. As Francesca Kekra Forsen reports from Accra, Ghanaians are excited and can't wait to cast their ballots today.
The streets of Accra are colourful with banners of the political parties, especially the ruling party NDC and the main opposition NPP. Campaigning by the political parties has officially ended, but hardly is there a streetlight or tree without a flag. Although most people are going about their normal activities, once in a while you will see someone wave a flag or chant slogans of the party they support. Taxi drivers honk at other drivers or pedestrians displaying the same party colours. President John Dramani Mahama is seeking a full term in office after taking over from John Atta Mills, who died in 2012. Accra resident Kwesi Nentri says he's excited to vote, but suggests he will not cast his ballot for the current president.
I'm excited because we've gone through 4 years of many troubles, particularly the economy. And that is what excites me, that I'm going to cast my vote.
Importer Frank Boama says he's also seeking change.
The election is all about the economy to me, because as a businessman, all I'm looking for is for the economy to be good. So let's say I can import more, get money, so things will be okay with me. We need people here to buy the goods from us so the money can stay in the country. But now, the government himself, gone to China himself, to bring the goods. So mine that I brought in, they're not buying. I'm not going to keep this president. I wish today we are just voting today so I can take him off.
But Bright Coker says he will vote for the president.
I want him to continue, because if we change him for now, for Ghana, you know, if we change our government, the infrastructure or the policy the government is doing, it will hold on stake.
Voting begins at 7 hours UTC and ends at 17 hours UTC Wednesday. The Electoral Commission says official results will be announced at most 72 hours after the polls close. Francisca Kakra-Forsen, VOA News, Accra.
The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs says she's optimistic Ghana will live up to its history of holding peaceful elections. Linda Thomas-Greenfield says the U.S. has spent $7 million to help support Ghana's democratic process and looks forward to working with whomever the Ghanaian people will choose as their next president. She told VOA's Peter Clotty, who is in Accra covering the election, that she has confidence in the Ghana Electoral Commission's ability to hold a free and fair election.
Ghana has a history of generally peaceful elections, And Ghana has a history of democracy. It's a beacon of democracy for most of the continent, but particularly for this region. So my expectation is that the people of Ghana will go to the polls on December 7th, and they will choose the president of their choice in a peaceful, free, and fair process. And the United States government will look forward to working with whomever the people choose to be their next president.
You met with officials of the Electoral Commission. Did they give you any reassurances? Because there have been some criticisms here and there.
There's always criticism of the Electoral Commission. They seem to be the lightning rod for criticism. But I would say that they are working diligently to prepare for an election that is credible. We talked about some of the challenges that they are facing and how they are working to address those challenges, to address the questions, to address disinformation, and also to make sure that the voting public has the right information to move forward in the election. So I left my meetings with them very confident that they are committed to a free and fair and transparent election. And I think my biggest concern is that the election process be a peaceful one and that the candidates call upon their supporters to support them with their vote, not in going into the streets. And any efforts to participate in violence should be called out, and people should be told that they will be held accountable if they use violence to promote themselves and to encourage their supporters.
So what's Washington's support to Ghana's democratic process?
You know, I would say I think it's clear from everything we've done, not just in the 3.5 years that I've been assistant secretary, that we support democracy and we support good governance on the continent of Africa. So the Ghana election is one that is very important to us. We have supported this process with about $7 million U.S. dollars that we have given partially to the Electoral Commission, to the Peace Commission, and also to civil society so that they can train election observers and election monitors.
Secretary Kerry recently had discussions with both the incumbent President John Dramani Mahama and Nanadu Dankwa Akufo-Addo, the main opposition leader. What was the import of the discussion between these two officials?
This was reported out in the press, so you've seen the report outs of the discussion. But the basis for the phone calls was to encourage both of them and urge both of them to encourage a peaceful process in the election and to make sure that none of their supporters use violence as a means of showing support to them. They were also both encouraged to sign the peace agreement, and they both did. We're very pleased about that.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke with viewers Peter Clotty, who is in Accra, to cover today's Ghana presidential election. Nigerian and UN officials say they can prevent the humanitarian crisis gripping northeast Nigeria from spinning out of control if the international community responds quickly to their plea for support. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
As part of its multi-billion-dollar humanitarian appeal for 2017, the United Nations is asking for more than $1 billion to meet the needs of nearly 7 million victims of the Boko Haram insurgency in northeast Nigeria. This is more than double the 2016 appeal. Nigerian National Planning and Budget Minister of State Zainab Ahmed says the request for more money is due to the military success in recovering communities that had been held by the militants.
But the paradox of the success is that as these areas are recovered, we now are exposed to people that are in a very, very fragile state. So the numbers keep changing as more communities are recovered.
The humanitarian operation will focus on the three most affected states, Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe. The United Nations is scaling up its aid operations as the magnitude of the human suffering becomes apparent. UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator Peter Lundberg says the protection crisis under Boko Haram is rapidly turning into a food insecurity and nutrition crisis.
We have an opportunity to address the needs. If we do them now, and if we get adequate resources to do it now, we can actually stop something quite terrible from happening, and we want to avoid that at any cost.
Lundberg says there is no time to lose, as many lives are at stake and children are particularly vulnerable. He says the UN Children's Fund warns the lives of many of the 400,000 severely malnourished children are at risk if they do not urgently receive desperately needed therapeutic feeding. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, December 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brela FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. The U.S. government is urging Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila and his political opponents to reach an agreement before the end of Kabila's term on December 19th. But time is quickly running out. Tom Perillo, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa, is in Kinshasa, the Congolese capital, and spoke with viewers William Klaus.
December 19th marks the end of DRC President Joseph Kabila's second five-year term. And many in the country are nervous as the date approaches. Elections were to have been held this year, but have not been organised. Kabila now plans to remain in office until polls can be held in 2018. A large opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, views the president's prolonged second and under the constitution final term as a power grab. This group wants him to leave at the end of his mandate and calls for elections in 2017. The lack of common ground between the parties has observers fearing a repeat of September 19th, when a Rassemblement demonstration in Kinshasa descended into violence. The United Nations says that security forces killed more than 50 people over 2 days. The US government and others in the international community are supporting the Catholic Church, known as CENCO, which is working to find a compromise. Tom Perriello, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region, is in Kinshasa meeting with Kabila and others. He spoke with VOA.
Our most urgent message is the absolute importance of full cooperation with the CENCO process run by the Catholic bishops to try to organize a broad consensus among the key stakeholders on how we can move forward. Even though we're in the 91st minute of stoppage time, the reality is there is still a bit of time on the clock here for the sides to come together.
Late last week, it appeared that the church's efforts had failed when Kabila's political alliance, the presidential majority, walked away from the mediation. But this week, the president reaffirmed his support for the process.
It was unfortunate that key members of the majority declared it dead. But perhaps fittingly for the bishops, it was resurrected on the third day, and we are back at it. And so I think partly as a matter of faith, we are going to continue to support this process in its entirety up until December 19th in the hopes that there can be a breakthrough.
Perriello says that the situation need not have reached this dangerous stage, and that both sides deserve some blame.
We've also been very clear publicly and privately with President Kabila that a statement 18 months ago, 12 months ago, or 6 months ago, stating with absolute clarity what remains crystal clear in the Constitution, would have been incredibly constructive, de-escalatory, and created much more space for dialogues.
Earlier this week, the head of the UN mission in the DRC warned of the possibility of a major outbreak of politically related violence on December 19th. Perriello noted that when there was political violence in Burundi, Washington imposed sanctions on individuals from both the government and opposition. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The Cameroon government has dispatched ministers and lawmakers from the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions of the country to their areas of origin in an effort to calm growing protests over the dominance of French in the country's institutions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Boya in southwestern Cameroon.
Thousands of supporters asked Cameroon's main opposition leader, John Frundi, to stop the singing of the national anthem in the English regions of Cameroon, calling it a foreign anthem. Frundi told them he was in Boya in support of ongoing strikes organized by lawyers and teachers.
We want the government to listen to the teachers and listen to the lawyers and do what they want them to do, because they are not just talking out of the air, they are talking out of tested and proven methods of teaching, tested and proven methods of practicing the law.
As Frundi and his party drove out of Boya, a convoy of government ministers, parliamentarians, businessmen and traditional rulers of the ruling CPDM party sent by President Paul Biya were driving in. Professor Elvis Ngole Ngole, a close aide of the president, said they want the population to stop the strikes. He says the government is aware there are challenges English-speaking Cameroonians are facing.
We have never sought to lose sight of the superior objective, which is that coming together and being together makes us better and better off than being separate.
The protests were started by lawyers who asked for French-speaking judges to be transferred out of courts in the English-speaking regions, stating that justice cannot be rendered when the judge, the advocate, and the suspect cannot communicate. They also asked for the Ohada business law used by French African countries to be translated into English. When their requests were not granted, they refused to defend clients in court and went to the streets. Teachers also got involved, complaining that French was being used in English schools to the detriment of English-speaking children. The situation escalated when university students and business people also joined. Many people have been arrested and several others killed since the military deployed to stop street protests in nearly every town in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Anglophones say the country's French majority is disrespecting Article 3 of Cameroon's constitution, which says the country is a bilingual and bicultural state. Peace advocate D. Richard Tanto of the NGO Ecumenical Service of Peace says the way forward is for the government to listen to the masses.
Along the lines, Anglophones have articulated their problem and they have made suggestions as to possible scenarios for resolution. But I have not seen that feedback coming from government. I have said several things about that problem and the need for the people to be heard, so that we look for structural issues which can rehabilitate or which can solve this problem of linguistic legacy that we have in this country.
The violence has led to the closure of all schools and markets in English-speaking regions of Cameroon, with protesters and military having running battles. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Boya.
Members of various religious groups in Malawi held street protests yesterday, Tuesday, against the proposed law that would liberalize abortion. The country's existing law allows only pregnant mothers whose lives are in danger to terminate their pregnancy. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from the capital, Lilongwe.
More than 20,000 people, including school children, medical personnel, and members of a Rastafarian sect, marched to the parliament in Lilongwe to protest the bill. Some of the placards they carried read, "A nation that kills its children is a nation without hope, no life, no rights, and thank you, mother, for not aborting me." The Episcopal Conference of Malawi, an arm of the Roman Catholic Church, and the Evangelical Association of Malawi, an umbrella body of 122 Christian denominations, led the protests. Reverend Father Henry Saindi is Secretary General for the Episcopal Conference of Malawi.
Our clear message is life begins at the moment of conception. Life of a human being was created in the image and likeness of God himself. So nobody has the right to decide to take life at whatever cost.
Current Malawian law restricts legal abortion services to pregnant women whose life is in danger. Proponents of the proposed new law say abortion should also be allowed to prevent injury to physical or mental health of a woman when the pregnancy results from rape, incest, or defilement, and when there is several malformation of the fetus. Protester Cecilia Nkonjera rejects the argument.
If my mother allowed me to carry me for 9 months, why am I supposed to take another life? Because that life has got the right to live. So that's why I was saying no. I am supposed to demonstrate that I am supposed to keep life, not to kill life.
Statistics from the Malawian Ministry of Health show more than 70,000 women seek backstreet abortion each year, and near 30,000 of them result in complications and sometimes death. The statistics further say post-abortion care, which is offered in public hospitals, costs the government nearly $1 million a year. The Coalition for Prevention for Unsafe Abortion is pushing the new abortion bill. Its national coordinator, Crispin Swande, told VOA Malawi's parliament is debating budgets for the Minister of Health, which is about $400,000, goes to abortion care.
In the petition, they're not addressing that. So even if they tell parliament, parliament consists of reasonable people who look for realistic solutions. And we believe that the parliament will opt for realistic solutions because the real problems have to be addressed by real solutions, not just noise.
The protesters have warned parliament members risk being voted out of office should they allow the bill to pass. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
There is no safe level of smoking, according to a new study. Even one cigarette a day can shorten your life, while quitting later in life can add years. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Decades of studies have demonstrated that cigarette smoking is harmful, but some people think if they only have a few cigarettes a day, maybe 10 or fewer, they're in the clear for smoking-related diseases such as lung cancer and heart disease. Not so fast, say researchers at the U.S. National Cancer Institute. The investigators conducted the first study looking at the health impact of so-called low-intensity smoking. The data came from questionnaires filled out by smokers taking part in a large, long-term study of 300,000 adults conducted by the National Institutes of Health. Epidemiologist or population expert Maki Inoue Choi from the Cancer Institute led the study.
In our study, we found the current smokers who consistently smoked less than one cigarette per day over their lifetime were 1.6 times more likely to die during the study compared to never smokers. And then those who consistently smoked between 1 and 10 cigarettes per day were 1.9 times more likely to die during the study than never smokers.
The health risks were lower among former low-intensity smokers compared to those who continued to puff away, and the risk of serious illness dropped the earlier someone quit. The study includes adults aged 59 to 82. Questionnaires were sent to participants in 2004 and 2005. Some of them began smoking when they were 15 or younger. During follow-up 10 years later, investigators found smokers who puffed one cigarette or less per day increased their risk of lung cancer by 9% compared to those who never smoked, and lung cancer death was 12 times higher among those who indulged in 1 to 10 cigarettes per day. There were also increases in early death from emphysema and heart disease. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dyke, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.